It is certainly good to see everyone again this evening. It's good to be back, to be able to worship God, to be able to listen to the message of God. If you would, turn in your Bibles to the book of Jude. We will continue our discussion in the book of Jude. Last time, which would have been Sunday night, we ended there at verse 10, where he says in verse 8, likewise, also these filthy dreamers, they despise defile the flesh, despise its dominion, and they speak evil of the dignities. Even Michael, the archangel, would not bring a railing accusation against Satan, but rather would say, the Lord rebuke you. Definitely some lessons and some concepts that we absolutely need, that we can't do that even to our fellow man. We can't do that to Satan. It is God's position to do those things. And then we see in verse 10, he talks about these. They speak evil of things they don't know, just like brute beasts, just like the beast of the field. All they go on is instinct. All they do is do what they know without thought, without thinking, without wondering about the Word of God and what should be done. And that brings us then to verse 11. Woe unto them. Now this is the aspect where we're going to get into to that rough language or that harsh language that Jude talks about. And we're going to see some extremely harsh language. What he's going to be saying in the next couple verses is these are useless, wasteless people, or wasteful people. They're useless. They're no good. Verse 11, he says, woe unto them. It's interesting because we see this also in the book of Matthew in chapter 23. 8 times there's the reference. 7 times it talks about woe unto these scribes and Pharisees, and 1 time woe unto thee blind guides. Jude uses the same phrase right here. Woe unto you. Or woe unto them. For they have gone in the way of Cain and ran greedily after the error of Balaam for reward and perished in the gainsaying of Korah. Now, the one thing we want to look at here, he's continuing his concept of threes. 3 examples of these useful people and what they have done, the way that they are going, the way of Cain, running in the aspect of in the error of Balaam, and perished in the gainsaying of Korah. Isn't it interesting how the progression is? You get in the way, that wrong way, the way that leads to destruction, and you just don't casually walk down that way, but now you're running down that way, and then what's the end? What's at the end of that way? Destruction. There's a progression here that he's doing. And we see that he talks about the way of Cain. If you turn to Genesis chapter 4. Genesis chapter 4, of course, we see the aspect or the situation with Cain. Starting with verse 1, and Adam and Eve, Adam knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bare Cain and said, I have gotten a man from the Lord. And again she bore Abel, and Abel was a keeper of the sheep. Cain was a tiller of the ground, and in process of time came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering unto the Lord, and Abel also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of his fat thereof. And the Lord had respect unto Abel and not unto his offering, but unto Cain and his offering he had not respect. And Cain was wroth. He was angry, and his countenance fell. So we see the situation that both of them offered as a sacrifice to God. God had respect unto Abel's. He did not have respect unto Cain's. And I firmly believe that Cain has not sinned at this point. He did an offering. God didn't accept it. Cain, I don't accept it. What do I accept is this type of offering. Do that. We see that God goes to him in verse 6, and the Lord said unto Cain, why are you angry? And why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not well, sin lies at the door. And unto you shall be his desire, and thou shalt rule over him. Cain did not like the idea. He did not accept what God said to him. He did not accept that God liked Abel's sacrifice, and he did not like his. So then what's the next thing we see? We see that he goes to talk, verse 8, and Cain talked with his brother. And then it came to pass, there in verse 8, that when they were in the field, that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and slew him. It's interesting that Cain went and talked to him, but it was a later time that when they were in the field, Cain slew his brother. Now, I'm convinced, I really can't prove this, but I'm convinced that Cain thought if he took away that sacrifice that Abel was giving, what is God going to have to accept? His sacrifice. He would have to accept his. So he thought, well, if I just took away this offering that God has respect to, he'll have to respect me. And we see that's not the way it works. We see that God does not have to do anything. We see how even though Cain tried that, it didn't work. God still had respect to that type of offering, as we see even through the old law. He did not go and say, okay, well, now I have to accept. No, he did not. But we see that Jude talks about that these have gone to the way of Cain. What way? What way have they gone? In 1 John chapter 3. 1 John chapter 3, starting with verse 11, it says, for this is the message that you heard from the beginning, that you should love one another. Not as Cain, who was that wicked one who slew his brother. And why did he slay him? Because his own works were evil and his brother's righteousness. His brothers were righteous. His were evil. He had those evil thoughts. He had that evil way. He had thinking that he will accept mine. I'm not doing his. And that's the way of Cain that Jude is talking about. It's interesting when we look at 1 John 3 and verse 13, where John says, marvel not, my brethren, if the world hate you. We started this lesson Sunday morning during the class hour, and we talk about Jesus saying, why are you marveling at this? And here we see John saying, don't marvel if the world hates you. Because the world has gone the way of Cain. The world is doing that same very thing, has that same very thoughts. I don't care about his way. He will accept my way. I will make him accept my way. And as we know, it didn't work with Cain. It won't work with anybody else. We also see in verse 11, for they've gone the way of Cain, and they ran greedily after the error of Balaam. Now, we all know the story of Balaam. Balaam, who wanted to go and curse these people that were traveling, and Balak, the king, wanted Balaam to come and curse them, and Balaam said, okay, I'll take your money. Because of the greed, because of the money, he wanted to do it, and God told him, you're not going to do it. Don't even go with them. It's not going to work. And Balaam told the men, the representatives, I can't go with you, but stay here. Wait till in the morning. He woke up and God said, you're not going to go with them. Eventually, Balak goes ahead and goes. Even God had said, you know, you can go with them, but it's not going to work. You will not curse Israel. And he goes. And God got mad at him because he went. Because he took it to say that, well, God said I could go, gave me permission when God said you could go, and it's still not going to work. So he goes, and even on the way, there was the mule that talked. Balaam doesn't even deem the concept of a talking mule. You would think all of us would be like, what? Look at this. Balaam's having an argument with the mule. There's no concept, thought that this mule's talking. He gets to Balak, tries to curse Israel. What comes out? Blessings. Balak's, what are you doing? You're supposed to curse them. And he said, didn't I tell you? Whatever God said, is that the only thing I can say? But it's interesting. Balaam didn't stop there. Balaam told Balak, you just wait and I'll show you how to curse Israel. I'll show you how you can beguile Israel. In Numbers 31, verse 15, Moses said to them, these are the ones who went out and destroyed Balak's kingdom, but they brought some women. Verse 15, you saved all the women alive. Behold, these caused the children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to commit trespass against the Lord in the matter of Peor. And there was plague among the congregation of Israel. The counsel of Balaam, he told Balak, this is what you do. You get your women to mingle, intermarry with theirs. You get your women to bring in these idol worships, these idols, and let them worship this. And their children of Israel will start doing that. And that's exactly what happened. Balaam was not a good character. I don't believe he ever was a good character. I don't really believe he was a prophet of God. It never really says that anywhere. God chose him to go and to bless Israel, even though he wanted to curse Israel because of greed. And then we have Revelation chapter 2. And in verse 14, but I have few things against you, because you have there them that hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit fornication. What are these things that we see that Balaam told Balak to do? The things that are all tied in to idol worship. He taught Balak, send your women to Israel. This is what's going to happen. And that's exactly what happened. Then we see, after the how they ran greedily after the error of Balaam for reward, they perished in the gainsaying of Korah. Korah was not satisfied with his course. Korah, who was a Levite, but was not of the lineage of Aaron. He was of the lineage of Levi, but not of Aaron. And Korah had their own course. Their course was to carry the things of the tabernacle. When they would break it down, when Aaron and the priests would cover up all the emblems and all the things of the tabernacle, then they would call Korah and his family, and they would pick it up and carry. Or they would drive the carts. Now, they didn't put the emblems on the carts, but they put the tent, the curtains, the things of the tabernacle on the cart. But all the emblems or all the things such as showbread, the candlestick, and the, of course, the ark of God, these were things that were all carried with staves. That would get David in trouble later when the Philistines took the Ark of God. And you know the story when the Ark of God went to one of the city of the Philistines, and their god, that idol, was there. And then every night they would come in, and the idol was prostrate before the Ark of God. And finally they had enough, and they sent it away. And then they said, well, they want to know how. And if you go back and look at it, they said on a new cart. Where did they get that? A lot of times I say that a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. Well, they had a little knowledge about new carts. They put the Ark of the Covenant on it. The whole story of the one that was on the cart, and then the hawk stumbled, and the Ark was about to fall, and he went out to steady it and touched it, and he was struck dead. Because the commandment of God is you do not touch these things. And right there where that happened, David, take it down, take it off the cart. They had this man, you take care of this for now. And it was there for some years until David found out how best way or how to transport it back to Jerusalem. Well, Korah did not like the idea of being a teamster. He did not like the idea of driving the carts and carrying the emblems and doing all these things. He didn't like the idea that Moses and the family of Moses and Aaron were the priests. He wanted to be the priest. In Numbers chapter 16, verse 1, it says, now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, the son of Dath, the son of Abiram, the son of Eleb, and On, the son of Pelah, the sons of Reuben, took men. And they rose up before Moses with certain of the children of Israel, 250 princes of the assembly, famous in the congregation, men of renown. And they gathered themselves against Moses and against Aaron and said unto them, you take too much upon you, seeing all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Wherefore then, why do you lift up yourselves above the congregation of the Lord? And Moses' reaction was, immediately fall down. It's funny because sometimes we use the expression, watch out, lightning might strike. And here we have Moses prostrating himself on the ground. Didn't say anything, just prostrate on the ground. And then he says in verse 5, he spake unto Korah and all his company, saying, even tomorrow the Lord will show who are his and who is holy, and will cause him to come near unto him, even him who he hath chosen, while he caused to come near to him. So do this. Take you censers, Korah, and all your company. Put fire therein, put incense in them before the Lord tomorrow. And it shall be that whom the Lord does choose, he shall be holy. You take too much upon you, you sons of Levi. And Moses said to Korah, here I pray you, you sons of Levi. Does it seem but a small thing to you that God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself to do service of the tabernacle of the Lord and to stand before the congregation as a minister unto them? And he hath brought you near to him and all your brethren, the sons of Levi, with you, and you seek the priesthood also? For which cause both you and all your company are gathered together against the Lord. What is Aaron that you murmur against him? This is exactly what they wanted. Korah wanted the priesthood. And as we know the end of this story, as we know what happens, the next day they all come near, and Moses says, whoever of these men, and it was Korah and a couple other men and other people supported them. Moses says, if these men die a natural death, God doesn't speak to me. I'm not a prophet of God. I'm not your leader. But if something happens this day, if the earth opens up and swallows them up, then I am the prophet of God. I am God's leader among you. And just as soon as he said that, we know what happened. The earth opened up and it swallowed up Korah and the two men that were with them and their families and their tents, everything they had, and it came back over. The other men that were supporting him, they took off and they ran. It's funny, a little bit later, they're going to have problems as well. But we see the end, the destruction, how Korah perished. Why? Because of the gainsaying that he said. And it's interesting, in Numbers chapter 39 and 40, after the ones that ran off, the ones that supported Korah and these other men, and they weren't swallowed up because of what had happened, they ran off and they dropped their censers. And God caused fire to come down on them. And we see in Numbers 16, verse 39, Eleazar the priest took the brazen censers wherewith they were burnt and offered. And they were burnt, had offered, and they were made broad plates for the covering of the altar, to a memorial unto the children of Israel, that no stranger, which is not of the seed of Aaron, come near to offer incense before the Lord, but be not as Korah and as his company, as the Lord said unto him by the hand of Moses. So they took these censers that these guys dropped. Eleazar beat them out flat, made a covering for the altar for a memorial. So the other people, the other course that will take over for Korah, the ones that would come and they'll pick all the things up and the curtains and the walls of the tabernacle and put it on a cart and all the emblems and the things that are by staves. There'll always be a memorial before them. Don't do like Korah. Because Korah perished. Perished in the gainsaying. Perished in the want for glory. Perished in thinking, I want to be the head guy. Exactly what Balaam wanted. Exactly what Cain wanted. And they all perished. Because what they wanted was not what God wanted. They cannot force God's hand. We cannot force God's hand. What the world doesn't understand, what we are to teach them, is that God is not, you are not going to force his hand. You want to live this lifestyle? Ain't going to work. You say that he's going to have to accept me. This is all I'm going to do to worship him, what I want? Not going to work. It's not going to work. Then in verse 12, we see that Jude continues, not only have they gone the way of Cain and ran greedily after the heir of Balaam and perished in the gainsaying of Korah, these are spots in your feasts of love. Now this could be taken a couple of different ways. We see there it continues, when they feast with you, feeding themselves without fear. We can take this two ways. We can take this just like the Lord's Supper. 1 Corinthians 11, verse 20, when you come together, therefore, into one place, this is not to eat the Lord's Supper. What they were doing, it wasn't eating the Lord's Supper, but rather they were doing something different, what they wanted. They had these divisions, and some of these divisions were doing this, and others were doing this. Some had nothing during a time when they were considered it being the Lord's Supper. Paul says, this is not to eat the Lord's Supper. He says, for in eating, everyone takes before him his own supper, and one is hungry, another is drunk. And what? Do you not have houses to eat and drink in? Despise you, the church of God? Shame them that have not? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you in this? I praise you not. Because they weren't doing the Lord's Supper correctly. From that point on, we see that Paul reiterates the institution of the Lord's Supper. He reiterates, this is how Christ gave it to me. This is how I gave it to you. Here it is again. You need it again. There is no divisions here. Everybody takes of the bread and waits. We have the verse, tarry one for another. That is so taken out of context. A lot of people, they say, we don't want to do it on Sunday morning. We have to wait because we got to wait till everybody's here. That's not what Paul's talking about. He's talking about that when you partake of the bread, wait. And when you're done, everybody who's here, when you're done, then do the fruit of the vine. You don't start the bread over here and the fruit of vine over here and say, well, you know, time frame. You know, Michael could preach a lot longer on Sunday morning if you did that. He likes to preach longer. But that's not the way it's to be done. You start the bread, it goes all the way around. You wait one for another. You tarry one for another until it's done. Then you start fruit of the vine. And then you don't get up and start singing or humming, as I've seen in one place where someone got up and was humming a well-known Lord's Supper song while they're partaking of the Lord's Supper. Well, you know, it kind of sounds like a good idea, doesn't it? Not what God has said. It's not what He authorized. He said, wait, tarry. We also can take this as when we come together in a social atmosphere. We have these brethren who are not right, and we're doing these things, and they sit there, and what do? But they cause strife within the church. They cause strife among the brethren. What is it? 6 things that God hates? Yes, 7 are an abomination. What's the very last thing? He who causes discord among the brethren. And this is who Jude is talking about. And then we see he says, these are clouds without water, carried about of winds. Trees whose fruit wither without fruit. Trees whose fruit withereth without fruit, twice dead, plucked up by the roots. Clouds without water. What good is a cloud that doesn't rain? What good is a cloud? Sometimes they'll give shade. One thing about clouds is they're there for a little bit and then gone. We're not talking overcast. We're talking about clouds that are in the sky and they're there a minute and then they move on. In fact, he says here, clouds without water carried about of winds. Well, what good are they? And then he talks about trees whose fruit withers without fruit, twice dead, plucked up by the roots. In Luke chapter 13, starting with verse 6, and he spake this parable, a certain man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard. And he came and sought fruit thereon and found none. And when he said unto the dresser of his vineyard, behold, these 3 years I come seeking fruit on this fig tree and find none. Cut it down. Why cumbereth it the ground? We have this tree and it does not produce fruit. What good is a tree that doesn't produce fruit? We see the landowner, because it was planted for that very purpose, to produce fruit, We have a landowner. He comes, and this is the third year. It's not had any fruit. Cut it down. Why waste this ground and the nutrients that are in the ground in growing things with this tree that does not produce fruit? Cut it down. And we see that the groomsman said, well, just a minute. He answered him unto him, he said, Lord, let it alone this year also, till I dig around it and I fertilize it. And if it bear fruit, great. If not, then you shall have it cut down. We see where God is giving everybody a chance to grow fruit, a chance to obey the gospel, a chance to be godly, a chance to do the will of God. He's given everyone a chance. But if we don't bear fruit, will be cut down. And then he's gave the gospel where, okay, here's the fertilizer. Dig around the trunk, dig around to the roots, and by the roots, take this nourishment. You'll bear fruit. But if you don't, twice dead. In Matthew chapter 3 and verse 10, we have John the Baptist telling the Jews to the Jews, and now also the axe is laid unto the root of the trees. Therefore every tree which brings not forth good fruits is hewn down and cast where? Into the fire. Twice dead. Twice dead. We also see where in verse 13, raging waves of the sea, foaming out their own shame. Now, raging waves of the sea, we saw 2 Samuel 22 and verse 5, Sunday, where David had this psalm. Verse 5 says, the waves of death compassed me. The floods of ungodly men made me afraid. We looked at that, ungodly men made me, the floods of ungodly men. Here we're seeing the waves of death compassed me. Raging waves of the sea. And then we see, he says, foaming out their own shame. Has anyone ever done a study or looked up what the foam in the sea is? It ain't good. It's not good. In fact, Isaiah chapter 57 and verse 20 and 21, it says, but the wicked are like the troubled sea when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt. There is no peace, saith my God, to the wicked. The waters, what do they stir up? What do they stir up? Mire and dirt. And science tells us that's exactly what waves on the beach does. It's exactly what this foam, the sea foam, is. In fact, I looked up the sea foam. I was curious about this verse. And this is what I found. The sea foam contains high concentrations of dissolved organic matter. Fish, jellyfish, everything in the sea, when it dies, it turns into organic matter. It's also, amongst that, is what is called the breaking down of algae bloom. And when polluted storm waters from land, when storm waters come into the ocean, where it meets the ocean waves meet the storm waters, and we have this foam. It says that this sea foam can be polluted with viruses and other contaminant. Michael and I had a problem with that word, contaminants. In fact, if there is some of this algae bloom, if it breaks down, if it dissolves, if there's direct contact with this foam or the inhaling of this foam, it can cause skin irritation and respiratory discomfort. So that foam, next time you go, do not let your children play in the foam. It's nasty stuff. But what's interesting is God told this all the way back in Isaiah. He told us all about that foam. It's mire and dirt. And Jude tells us, what is this? But foaming out their own shame. Mire and dirt and just ugliness. Uselessness. And then we have wandering stars to whom is reserved the blackness, darkness forever. Wandering stars. When a star burns out, it all of a sudden does not stop its course. It doesn't stop and dissolve. But it keeps on going. Keeps on going in its course, going where it's supposed to go. Just that it's not shining light anymore. It's dead. And this is what Jude is talking about. A light that is gone, a light that's burned out. We are to be the light of the world, but if we disobey God, if we fall away from God, our lights, what are they? They are burned out. And unless we come back to God, we are this, who is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. And then we get to verse 14 and 15, we have a reference to Enoch, verse 14 and 15. And Enoch, also the seventh from Adam, prophesied of thee, saying, behold, the Lord comes with 10,000 of his saints. Now we just got done talking about how useless these people are. They've gone after the way and ran greedily after the error and perished in the gainsaying. And these people are, they're useless and they're completely useless. And Enoch prophesied about these, and here's his prophecy. Behold, the Lord cometh with 10,000 of his saints to execute judgment upon all and to convince all that they are ungodly among all them, of all their ungodly deeds which they have ungodly committed and of all their hard speeches which ungodly sinners have spoken against him. The word ungodly, our word that we started with in this series in verse 4, is mentioned six times. One time in verse 4, four times here in this prophecy of Enoch. Now, this prophecy, to talk about this prophecy, it is attributed to Enoch. Jude records this as a prophecy. It is a prophecy. Evidently, Enoch did state this. Now, there is in the world what we call First and Second Enoch. Books contributed to Enoch. We do not have them in our gospel. They do not pertain anything to life and godliness. So they're not needed. But if there's a passage that it's there that is needed, we have it right here. Jude talks about it. He talks about how the Lord comes with his 10,000s of his saints. If we had time, we would go into the number 10,000. It's kind of an interesting study. Do that on your own at some point. The Lord comes with his 10,000s of his saints to execute judgment upon all them that are ungodly. And their ungodly deeds, which they have ungodly committed, and of all the things they said, which ungodly sinners have spoken. Wow. Jude, or Enoch, I should say, tell us what you really think of these people. They're ungodly, just like verse 4. Where verse 4, that they were attributed to this condemnation way back when? The seventh from Adam. Ungodly men. It's interesting, we have this verse. We actually, depending on the version of translation of 1st and 2nd Enoch, is this comment that Enoch makes, it's in one or the other translation. It's in either 1st Enoch or 2nd Enoch, depending on the translation. There is no Hebrew translation. There is only Aramaic and then one that is called Gehiz. So then we come to verse 16. He talks about all these ungodly people. He talks about all these things that they've ungodly committed. All these things these ungodly sinners have spoken against God. He says in verse 16, these are murmurers. Now we've seen murmurers. We know murmurers. We can look in the Old Testament and we can see murmurers. Can we not? How many times do we have record of the Old Testament murmuring against God? How many times in the New Testament can we see murmuring? How many times have we heard in our own congregations murmuring? And yet we have here, he talks about these are murmurers, complainers, walking after their own lusts. Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 5, it says, And ye have forgotten the exhortation which speaks unto you as children, my sons. Despise not you the chastening of the Lord. Don't faint when you are rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is he that the Father doesn't chasten? What does that sound like? Cain, who did not endure the chastening of God. But if ye be without chastisement, whereof are all the partakers, then you are bastards and not sons. Furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection under the Father of spirits and live? For they verily for a few days chasten us after their own pleasure, but he for our profit, that we might be takers of his holiness. Now, no chastening for the present seems to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. We come back to fruit, don't we? And then we say in verse 16, they walk after their own, or they're complainers. There's murmurers, and there's complainers. In the book of Lamentations, chapter 3, verse 39. Wherefore does a living man complain? A man for the punishment of sins? The writer says, why do those who are suffering punishment for sin, why are you complaining? Isn't that righteous? Isn't that just? God punishes because we sinned? Verse 40, let us search and try our ways and turn again unto the Lord. Look at our ways. Have we gone the way of Cain? Are we running the greed of Balaam? Is destruction our end? Look at your way, the way you're going. What's the end? You can see it. You know it. You know what that end is. And then as we finish out verse 6, we have walking after their own lusts. James chapter 4 and verse 1. From whence come wars and fightings among you? Come they not hence, even the lust that war in your members? You lust and you have not. You kill and desire to have and cannot obtain. You fight and war, yet you have not because you ask not. You ask and receive not because you ask wrong or amiss, that you may consume it upon your lusts. Ye adulterers and adulteresses, know you not that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God. Check your way. Check your way. Are you being guided by lusts of the things of what you want? Lust of the things. Well, God, this is the way I'm going to worship you. You have to take it. No, 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 no. No, he does not. And then we see having men's persons in admiration because of advantage. Their mouth speaketh great swelling words, having men's persons in admiration because of advantage. Those are the ones that in our feast, these are spots in our feast, these are the ones they sit down, they eat with us, they talk a good game, they act a good game, but their goal is not to encourage, it's not to build up, but rather it's, what can I get out of this? What can I get? In Acts chapter 8 and verse 9, there was a certain man called Simon, who before time in the same city used sorcery, bewitched the people of Samaria, giving out that he himself was some great one to whom they all gave heed, from the least to the greatest, saying, this man is the great power of God. Which is worse? The people saying, oh, you, this is the great power of God, or Simon saying, I'm the great power. Then Philip comes along, and obviously the power of the gospel, the confirming of what he says through miracles and such things, people will understand and see the true power of God. And they obey the gospel, even to the point where Simon himself obeys the gospel. Why? Because he understood he wasn't the great God, the power of God. He understood there is a power of God, and it wasn't him. These others saw it, and they obeyed the gospel. Simon obeyed the gospel. Yes, he kind of messes up a little bit later. He kind of reverts back to the way, that old way. He reverts back saying, oh, if only I could have this power to lay my hands on and give the Holy Ghost, I'll be back to that status, the great power of God. How many times have we reverted back to the old person, to the old? That's what Simon did. Not to excuse him, he just reverted back. He went to Peter and he said, can I buy this power? And then we talk about harsh language. Peter had some harsh language. Your money perish with you for the thought of thine heart, that you could purchase the Spirit of God. For I understand you were in the gall of bitterness. I almost did it, Michael. Acts chapter 8. I better read it because I will not get it right. Peter said to him in verse 20, that your money perish with you because you have thought that the gift of God may be purchased with money. You have neither part nor lot in this matter, for your heart is not right in the sight of God. Repent therefore of this your wickedness. Pray to God, and perhaps the thought of your heart will be forgiven you. For I perceive that you are in the gall of bitterness and in the bond of iniquity. That bond, you're back in that bond of iniquity, because he reverted back. Peter says, pray to God. And now, to Simon's credit, you pray for me. You pray for me so that none of these things come upon me. There might be some here this evening not obeyed the gospel. You can, by being baptized for the remission of your sins. Being baptized into Jesus Christ, being baptized in water, raised up a new man in the spirit and in truth. There might be some who have obeyed and haven't lived the way that you should. Sometimes we all revert back. And we can pray to God, have our sins forgiven. Or if it's a situation where we need the prayers of the congregation, just like Simon, ask for the brethren to pray for you. There's no greater aspect of prayer than having brethren pray for me. The invitation is extended. If you accept, please come forward. As together we stand and sing this song.